Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. I'm your host, Scott Livingston, and this is where I explore the influences that have shaped the lives of our incredible guests. These are the stories of lives worth talking about. Follow me on Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, or link up with me on my Facebook fan page, Scott G. Livingston. My goal is to empower and inspire a community of people who take every opportunity to live a high-performing life.
Our key sponsor, Vald, is fast becoming one of the key innovators in human performance. They provide practitioners with a wide range of technologies for measuring, monitoring, and improving musculoskeletal health. And they are trusted by thousands of clinics, hospitals, sporting teams, and defense departments around the world. Vald has objective measurement solutions for you. The Dynamo handheld dynamometer and inclinometer, force decks, dual force plates, force frame strength testing, human track movement analysis system, and Norbor hamstring testing system. Together, they are capable of measuring and monitoring almost every major function of musculoskeletal and movement health. If you're looking to take your performance game to another level, Vald can help you become an objectively informed practitioner. Visit www.vald.com today for more information on their complete line of products. The two most expensive things in life are following bad advice and breakdowns in communication. The Art of Coaching Apprenticeship course gives you the tools and strategies necessary to navigate tough conversations, better understand human behavior, and improve your ability to think on the spot. Whether you're a people pleaser who struggles with hard conversations, someone who wants to be better at negotiating, or you simply want to improve your ability to think on your feet, the apprenticeship can help. It's 2 days, highly interactive, and allows you to get feedback that will help you in every aspect of your personal and professional life. I participated in this course, and I know through my own experience that it's going to change the way you communicate, participate, and lead in life. On June 22nd and 23rd of this year, the Art of Coaching Apprenticeship is coming to Calgary, Alberta. And if you are a Leave Your Mark listener, you can benefit from $100 off the registration price of this important and powerful course using the coupon code LYMAOC, all in caps. Head over to artofcoaching.com today and register. Do you find yourself challenged to bring all your disparate skills and tools together to create more effective client solutions? Are you challenged to play in the gray area between injury and performance when injuries keep coming back or performance issues keep reoccurring? Are you seeing what's happening in neuroscience today and wondering how to bring it into your practice? Neuroreconditioning is an operating system for bringing the worlds of therapy and performance together under the overreaching lens of applied neurology. So many of the professionals who've begun their reconditioning journey remark how it just brings everything they've ever learned together, helping them make better technical and tactical decisions, and in turn getting better and longer lasting results. Neuroreconditioning is a three-step process that begins with our signature course, R1 Foundations, where you'll learn how to assess movement, understand the drivers of pain and performance issues, and provide interventions to the neurological system, and integrate your own approach and practice so it works for you, in your environment, and with your clients. Head over to reconditioninghq.com and get your free download and start making a difference for your clients today. We've taken care of those that take care of us. On to the podcast. Hello and welcome to Leave Your Mark. Today, I have the pleasure of speaking with Andrew Eaton. Andrew is a teacher integrating traditional strength training, mindset coaching, and brain-based physical training. He found his way to weight training as a response to being bullied in middle school. The lessons learned there laid the foundation for an entire career. After college, he was certain that a career in radio was the next step in his journey, but he found himself instead writing and editing a periodical for back care professionals. Then 10 words in a flyer at a gym changed his trajectory, advertising the first personal training certification course on the East Coast. Shortly after completing that course, a chance encounter while visiting family found him relocating halfway across the U.S. to take a ground floor position in a facility the Chicago Bulls called home. Once there, like many fitness nerds, he set out to learn as much as possible, wanting to become something of a fitness Swiss Army knife. He also met his wife and her son, and they had two children together. Over the following 10 years, he left the club and started Eaton Sports and Fitness, designed to support athletes on their path towards performance. The last decade has included certifications in nutrition, mindset, and most recently, the revelation that he'd been missing a significant piece of his education. Andrew lives in Illinois with his daughter, Kate, and his grand dog, Fiona. Welcome, Andrew.
Thanks very much for including me, Scott.
Pleasure to have you on, sir. Our paths have kind of crossed circuitously through what I would say is the end of your journey of sort of re-examination of the way you practiced. But the way I sort of dig into this process of leave your mark with my guests is I kind of go back to the start, and I found a lot of interesting threads in your bio. So if we go way back, like what is kind of influencing you as a kid, and what is happening in the schoolyard that you're experiencing bullying, and what does that do to you, or how does that change your trajectory in some way?
Well, I grew up in a very small rural town in New Hampshire, and middle school was the first time that two towns had come together. So it brought two student bodies together. And, you know, having grown up in the same small towns, there was a clique from my town, there was a clique from the other town. And what I eventually found was when the two communities were coming together in the gym locker room, mm-hmm. there was a little bit of, you know, animosity or territorialism mm-hmm. happening between the two groups. And I found myself as, I guess, an average size guy, but slightly below average size, was getting knocked around by one specific guy. And I found myself tiring of that rapidly. And, you know, for most of us at this age who still remember comic books, the back of the comic books always had the Charles Atlas story. Hmm. You know, a skinny guy goes to the beach, encountered with a bully ensues, he gets sand kicked in his face, and then he goes and decides to take care of himself and become a much better version of himself, stronger physically. And, you know, the next summer goes back to the beach and handles his business and knocks out the bully. I had no visions of knocking out the bully. I just wanted to get stronger.
Right.
So I went to my dad. And I asked if we could get some weights. And as it turned out, he had his Hollywood barbell set from his high school weight workouts in my grandfather's basement.
Wow.
So we went down there and dragged that out of the corner of the basement. And I grew up in a farmhouse. We didn't have animals, but we still had the horse barn. So my first gym was actually a horse stall. Just set up the bench, went and got a couple of gold-covered plastic dumbbells, bought a book, and, you know, started pumping plastic. And it was, I don't know, a couple weeks later, found myself back in the locker room, and I got moved aside by the same kid, and I pushed back. And for a split second, I thought I'd made a very bad error, because he started to turn around, and I thought, they don't show this in the comic book.
Right.
But he turned halfway around, gave me a look, and I guess decided it wasn't worth his trouble anymore. So that was at the end of that. And I thought, you know, this works for me. And I never let it go. And even as not, you know, the biggest guy, having that sense of underlying confidence going into those situations in mixed environments mm-hmm. did carry forwards.
Wow.
And I think I've written about utilizing that concept of sort of a secret identity underlying what you're walking around with. So, you know, knowing that that strength was there carried me forwards into a lot of different environments where probably my fifth or sixth grade self wouldn't have been comfortable.
That's really cool. I love that story. I forgot about the Charles Atlas in the back of the magazine story, but yeah, that is...
I still have it somewhere in a file. I ordered it because I had to have it.
That reminds me a lot of being... It's funny, you and I met through a mentorship in neuro and applied neurology, and we've always sort of gotten along online and finally met one another face to face. But I think we have some very similar background noise in the sense that I had the same thing growing up. My friends, you know, you had to create the gym and went and got 2x4s and cold rolled steel and a bunch of, you know, plates and created this kind of basement gym and lifted weights when, you know, really lifting weights wasn't, well, I mean, it was for this kind of odd dimension of reality in magazines and stuff back in the day. So,
yeah, not for the average individual.
Yeah, well, I was doing it to play football. Did you play any sports growing up? Were you influenced by sport in some sense? Yeah,
I played baseball, ran track, played soccer, a lot of running, apparently. And then, you know, the usual kind of, we played pickup football and the usual things. But I didn't do anything contact.
Mm. What did growing up on a farm contribute to you as a human being now, in some sense?
Well, the farm, we essentially inherited the farm. I mean, by the time we got to it, it was no longer a farm. It was a farmhouse with a large barn on the property. But it was a lot of land. Mm. So I'd say one of the things that it contributed to was becoming willing to explore a little bit. Mm. So a lot of the property off the back part of the yard proper was wooded. Mm. So I would just go out into the woods and sort of, there are trails here and there, but it's going out and exploring, and you find a stream as a kid and you got to build a bridge across the stream because there's no sense using the crossing that's already there. You got to make your own way. But I think what it lent itself to was a lot of exploration and I guess a love of learning that if you're assigned to mow the lawn, you should learn to love to mow the lawn, because that was one of my responsibilities was, here, take this push mower. And of course, this is pre motorized mowers. This is just the other side of a spinning, whirling blade. But I think, like, growing up in a small town does create some awareness of the importance of relationships.
Mm.
Because everybody knows each other,
right?
For better or for worse. So you've got to hold yourself to a standard, because, you know, you're representing not just yourself in that community, you're representing your family.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of important.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that actually carries forwards today. I don't know if there's so much. I think it's maybe in pockets.
You right. See a
lot of, like, integrated families that spend a whole lot of time together. I feel like there's a lot more just kind of everybody's out sort of spinning in their own a family orbit, but not necessarily super connected.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Actually, I saw a little blurb the other day of an interview with the president of Mexico, and he made some commentary on the United States in the sense that he thinks one of the strengths of the Mexican culture is the family. And he thinks that that's kind of been lost in the U.S. culture over the last 20, 30 years. And to some degree, I would agree with that. I think that was the strength of the United States, and it's probably something that's it's struggling with now in some ways. Is that what you would notice in some sense from your growth, growing up?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, yeah. I think there's a lot of, I mean, when I moved here, so I moved to the middle of the country, moved to Illinois from New England. And one of the significant community differences was that I moved into a large population of Jewish people. And it's that community remains super tight.
Mm.
I mean, I watched the way that the families that I, you know, my kids grew up with, and we were neighbors with, and we spent time with, and it seemed like a little bit of a recreation of what I grew up with. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Family was really important. The family unit was the first thing. And then everything else kind of just grew from that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of lucky to move back into an environment, into a bunch of communities that all still valued that.
That's cool.
Which I found very cool.
The second, what seems to be a relational context for you and I was, and I didn't know this until I read your bio, was this career in radio. I wanted to go into radio and television arts when I was a kid and be a radio talk DJ. What was drawing you to that, and why did that not happen for you?
Not happen. Yeah. Lack of knowledge. When I was in high school, I did not do anything with voice, did a few things with music, but the music teacher had stated at the time that he really thought I should do something with my voice. The one voice thing that I did in high school, there was a song at the time, I'll be dating myself here, but by the Manhattan Transfer, and they had taken the title theme to Twilight Zone and they'd made it into a song.
Hmm.
And it was Rod Sterling who does the voiceover at the very beginning of each episode. At the beginning of that song, there is that voiceover. So he thought it would be great if I just dressed up as the host and stood off to the stage and basically read his part before the school band played the song. My one time on stage, it was enough. I mean, as a 16-year-old kid, I'm kind of going, just put a spotlight on me so I can't see anybody else, and I'll read as best as I can. And then I hit college, and the college had a radio station.
Okay.
And opportunities to host a radio show. And I thought, well, that could be fun, cool. I've thought about doing that. So you get an FCC license. They certify you on how to use the radio station. And I had a show for a couple of semesters, just playing blues music from all sorts of artists that most people have never heard from at like 6 a.m., which means most people still haven't heard of them. But it was fun, and I enjoyed it.
Mm.
And I thought, you know, this could be kind of an interesting way to move forwards. And when I was getting to the end of school, I looked into three radio stations, I think, that were local.
Hmm.
Booked interviews, showed up at the first one, and the manager, or hiring manager, asked for my demo tape. And the process of the application process at the time didn't say anything about requiring. I thought you just go in and have a conversation and they listen to your voice and
say, I want to do this.
You sound good. Let's just put you on the air. That's not how it works. So the statement that I was left with was, your voice will get you through the door, but you actually need some demo material if you want to go any further than that. And at that point, my show was over. And there was no opportunity to get back into the studio and record some, or at least get some pre-recorded stuff. Mm-hmm. So I went to a couple other local radio stations and basically had the same experience. So I had to just put that aside and make other plans.
Mm-hmm.
So my education had been in English lit, and a lot of ologies and osophies. So find me a sociology or a philosophy and I'm all in. Because I always wanted to learn about, I wanted to be able to learn about people and I wanted to be able to communicate. So for a liberal arts education, I was getting everything that I wanted.
Mm.
And I thought, okay, well, those two things would probably serve as a vehicle to almost anything.
Right.
At least at some level, not math. Still there be no math. But I had to, you know, I had to recalculate like a GPS system. I was like, okay, well, I can't take the road that I wanted to take. So where am I going to go? And thought back on what's been the one thing that's been consistent in my life since I was 11, 12, mm-hmm. was always physical activity. There's mm-hmm. always something in the gym. And if we think about that outliers concept of 10,000 hours, by the time I got to college, I'd been working on weights and learning things since I was 11 years old. I, comparatively speaking, knew a lot. Mm-hmm. Found myself in the weight room at the college, suggesting things, making changes and helping people out. I mean, certainly not in a professional way, but it was the first opportunity to interact with people in that kind of vein, where now I was taking a little bit of a teaching role. Mm. And I thought, all right, well, let's look at health clubs. So this was 1990. In 1990 on the East Coast, there really was not a significant fitness environment. You could do two things in a health club. You could apply for management, or you could teach at group exercise classes. Mm. And my calves do not look great in leg warmers. So I thought, I'm going to try the other direction. And I applied to a couple of management companies, Connecticut, and I think there was one in Massachusetts. But they were looking for people who were coming out of more management programs, which I also didn't. So I ended up back at the health club that I had gone to with my mom, learning to play tennis over the summers. Big family club, a few hundred thousand square feet, and took a job as a front desk guy and did some shift work for them, and was writing for a back hair newsletter, doing some writing and editing and doing short interviews for articles for chiropractors and DCs and DOs. And that was fine. It was paying the bills mostly. Mm-hmm. Gave me a chance to interact with multiple different people from various walks of life. And my mom knew that my whole physical program was really important. So she bought me a membership to a Gold's Gym out there. And I was just doing my thing, being the muscle head guy, and walked through the gym at one point and to the locker room. There's this piece of paper on the wall, pink, baby, that said, "Love your work as much as you love your workout." And I thought, oh, what is this? And it was a certification course for personal trainers.
Okay.
The first thing I'd ever seen in my area. So hopefully they had another one of those flyers, because I took that one.
I put it in my bag. That's the reason there was only one person in the course.
It was a very small class. Probably. Nobody else from my neighborhood. So I went home. My folks had split at that point. So my mom had moved to Illinois. My dad was still in Massachusetts, and we were living together. And I took the flyer back home, and I said, I really want to do this, but I didn't have the tuition. Mm. And the look on his face, I think, was, wait, 4 years of prep school, 4 years of private college, and he wants to clean equipment in a gym. that's not what it is, but that was clearly the look on his face. But to his credit, he gave me the tuition to go take the course. And it was twice a week for 8 or 12 weeks, and it was 45 minutes each way down close to Boston. One class in, I was hooked. Yeah, it was just what I wanted, and gave me. And they to their credit, I think they did a really good job for not having a lot of experienced people to work with. Mm-hmm. The company was Fitness Resource Associates, which I believe eventually became the Aerobics and Fitness Association of America. And went national.
Interesting.
But I think that was the kernel of where AFA started.
Yeah. There's a lot of interesting little startups at that period of time that who knows where they went or what they became. What did you like when you say it hooked you? What did you fall in love with in the beginning, and are you still in love with the same aspect of what you fell in love with originally?
What I found in that class, I think the first thing I found was that there are other people who are on this journey with me that kind of fell in love with the same thing, if not for the same reasons, but fell in love with the same thing. Like physically feeling strong and then wanting to take that feeling and try and share it with other people.
Mm.
I think that was the underlying feeling in the group.
Mm.
People were certainly coming from all over the place, but so that was probably the first thing. The second thing was creating some organization around all the things that I was kind of thinking about.
Mm-hmm.
So when I left college, I wanted to do something in that realm where, okay, I was in the gym with people, helping them learn how to move better, move more safely, whatever. But I wanted to be able to do that on at least a slightly broader scale. And there seemed at that time to be no vehicle to go directly do that.
Mm-hmm.
The only way training was done around me at that time was just bodybuilding. That was kind of, you know, it wasn't performance training. It wasn't, you know, anything like fat loss. It was just you go and you do group exercise classes if you want to lose weight, and you go and you do bodybuilding if you want to get big and strong.
Mm-hmm.
But that course provided me a direction, sort of a vehicle that I could then use to say, okay, if this vehicle exists, then it gives me an opportunity to drive it someplace.
Mm-hmm.
So even if I didn't have at that moment a place where I was going to go, because again, in New England, there weren't really a lot of options in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to give me some direction at some point. And I would have that at the time advanced knowledge in my back pocket if and when the opportunity presented itself.
So then I assume based on what you wrote, you had a sort of a chance encounter and gravitated towards the Chicago area or Chicago, I assume, if it was in this that facility. So what was that chance encounter?
Yeah.
My
parents had split up. My mom moved to Illinois. Okay. And she was working in a prep school here, working in admissions. And because of the divorce, I hadn't seen her for a while. So I drove out to visit. And because she was working a day schedule and I had nothing to do, I figured I'd find a gym. And this was back in the day of the Yellow Pages, where you could flip open a phone book and find things. So I flipped it open and there's an advertisement, top left corner, Deerfield Multiplex, training facility of the Chicago Bulls. The tagline for the gym was, "It's the only game in town." And I thought, well, I mean, I'm here and the Bulls, of course I'm going to go check it out, right? So I drove down and took a tour. And the young guy who gave me the tour, he was 34, 35 at the time. We're walking around the gym and showing me the place, and just sort of, you know, not an interview, but basically just chatting me up as we're going. He says, "Well, you know, where are you from?" And I told him. He said, "Well, what do you do?" And I said, "Actually, I was just certified to be a fitness trainer." "Are you looking for a job?" I thought, "Are you kidding?" I said, "I certainly could be." So we finished the tour. He said, "Do you have a resume?" And I said, "Well, I could get you one." Now, I didn't have a resume, but I had access to my mother's office. So I drove to school, asked her if she could get me into the office. I typed up a resume, copied it off on some nicer paper, took it back to the gym, dropped it off. And I got a phone call. That was probably Monday. I got a phone call probably Wednesday from the guy who was the fitness manager. Said, "I've got your resume here. I'd love to talk to you." I said, "Great. When?" He says, "How about in an hour?" I have nothing but time. So I drove down and I met with him. We chatted for a bit. We're of like mind. And said, "Well, if you want a job, you got it if you want it."
Wow.
So I finished up my vacation with my mom. I drove my Honda Civic 18 hours back to Massachusetts, broke my lease, packed up everything that fits in a Honda Civic, drove it back out here. That was September 91. And I had the good fortune to work at that gym for 13 years and pick up a lot of education in that gym. It was really the first formal opportunity to teach and to do some training. But it was also my first opportunity to do any significant management.
Okay.
Because eventually the guy who hired me left and I assumed his job.
Okay.
And took over the personal training and then eventually became the fitness director. So there was a lot of, like I said, a lot of education there, not just teaching people and working in the fitness field, like with working out, but dealing with different levels of people within an organization and learning how to navigate that. One of the more challenging things I remember was when I got elevated to the personal training manager, I'd been working shoulder to shoulder with my staff for years. So there was I'm moving now into this role where I have responsibility and I'm kind of like able to instruct them or guide them towards things that they need to do as part of their jobs. And there wasn't always an immediate level of respect because they're like, yeah, we'll get to that. And it's like, no, I kind of need to do that now. What? So there was a little pushback. And it's understandable, but sure. It was a learning experience for sure.
Interesting. Must have been interesting, actually, when the Netflix series Last Dance came out, because that you were living in that space during that zenith period. Like, tell me a little bit about your own experience with that, living around that over those years, and what maybe the show brought back to you in some sense.
The thing the show brought back, I mean, when they filmed all that, it was well before they had done a lot of renovations around the gym. So at the time they filmed it, the Bulls were training there for basketball. They were training there because they built a weight room just adjacent to the court. Several small rooms just off the hallway back there were press rooms where all the reporters from the Tribune and the Sun-Times and all that were doing their reporting from the facility. There was a, just adjacent to that, there was a physical therapy department that was also kind of ensconced and well-entrenched with them. So you see a lot of, you get a very up close and personal view, and that like a lot of the Bears trained there also.
Mm-hmm.
So they would come out and just be normal people. You expect to be like, whoever. But, when you're standing on a treadmill next to, a guy who's 6'8", a guy who's 6'6", and you're just talking about family or what they did for dinner or, it's just, they're just people.
Mm-hmm.
On some level, people with a lot of money, but people, but, like anything, you see different aspects of different people as you get to know them.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some who were perfectly willing to be conversational and chat it up. And there were others who just didn't want any part of the public.
Right.
And I think, the more media adulation you're subject to, the more I understand being held at arm's distance if you're not in that immediate circle.
Mm-hmm.
So I do remember seeing a lot of craziness. I think when they left to go to the first championship rally, they left from the club. And I remember them leaving through the laundry room, through the back alley to get on a bus to go downtown to do the rally. Because there are people just lining the exits, waiting for them to come out.
Right.
But it was kind of cool, obviously, just to be around those guys who are, training and working at the highest level of their sport. We got the opportunity just before they built their own training facility. They all came in, 98% of them came in and hung out with us and signed whatever we wanted. And, you know, just did kind of it was almost like a friends and family night.
Mm-hmm.
We'd been around them for so long and they'd been around us for so long. That was sort of their goodbye gift to us.
Oh, very cool.
It's pretty cool.
Did you run into Al Vermeil in your time? I guess
Yep. Al. Well, of course, Al was the strength coach for the Bulls at the time.
Right. Yeah.
And when they opened the Berto Center, which was maybe like a quarter mile, half a mile away from Multiplex, Al was there. Eric Helland also was the assistant strength coach at the time. So one of the guys who had come to the Multiplex around the time that I took over the personal training department was from another gym, and he knew Al. So we ended up with a little bit of an in to go over and hang out at the Berto Center once or twice and learn from Al.
Mm.
So he had, I don't remember what his, I know he had like a principles of training that he had put together very early on. So I remember, you know, any of the staff that wanted to go could go over and Al and his son sort of demonstrated it for us and took us through some of our paces.
Mm-hmm.
That was one of the opportunities that was presented there that, you know, it's just rare.
Mm-hmm.
You don't run into stuff like that. It's just, you know, if you're 1 or 2 degrees of connection from somebody like that, take advantage of it if you can.
Mm-hmm. Who were early influencers for you on maybe the way you practiced, so to speak, in your profession?
Quick break here. We'll be back to the podcast in just a minute. I want to help Vald spread their message and mission to help performance professionals do their best work and serve their clients most effectively. Vald is all about providing practitioners around the world with a range of technologies for measuring, monitoring, and improving musculoskeletal health. They offer a wide variety of testing solutions for you and your practice to deliver valuable, objective measures. Along with helping you measure just about anything you might need to know about performance, Vald also offers a wide range of completely free digital health solutions, granting you easy access to powerful, engaging digital tools for every step of your clinical treatment pathway. Visit www.vald.com for more information today. If you're someone who pushes yourself relentlessly, craves feedback, and will do anything to grow, then you'll love the Art of Coaching Apprenticeship. This 2-day course offers an intensive deep dive into all things communication and psychology. Taken together, you'll gain the skills necessary to navigate conflict, get out of your own head, and improve your ability to build lasting buy-in with others. True growth is a matter of you versus you. The Art of Coaching Apprenticeship provides you with communication strategies, opportunities to practice, and the framework you need to overcome anxiety, help you quit overthinking, and improve your ability to have tough conversations. On June 22nd and 23rd, the Art of Coaching Apprenticeship is coming to Calgary, Alberta. If you are a Leave Your Mark listener, you can benefit from $100 off of the registration price of this important and powerful course using the coupon code LYMAOC, all in caps. Head over to artofcoaching.com today and register. Nothing is more frustrating than a client that keeps coming back with the same injury or performance issue. It's frustrating for the client, and it's challenging for you, the practitioner. At reconditioninghq.com, we know you want to make the difference. You want to be able to use all the skills and knowledge you've acquired to find the solutions. But we also know it can be challenging to bring all the skills, tools, and knowledge acquired through different information sources together in a cohesive and systematic approach that creates high-impact results. That's why we started teaching neural reconditioning to help you bring all of the power you possess together in one powerful approach under the lens of applied neurology.
Once you begin to practice neuro reconditioning, you'll wonder why you waited so long to get started. And getting started begins with our signature course, R1 Foundations. For more information on how to level up your practice starting now, head over to reconditioninghq.com for your free download today. Now, let's get back to our podcast.
Early on, boy, I mean, I think the first certification program that changed my perspective on things was the National Academy of Sports Medicine. Early on. So that was back when Dr. Bob Goldman was in charge of NASM. And I think I was part of one of the last 4-day programs that they held where, you know, it's 2 days of teaching and then 2 days of testing. And the thing that was so cool for me about the testing was that you actually had to demonstrate what you knew. Mm-hmm. And that was not present in any of the other programs that I'd seen to that point. A lot of it was, you know, if you're an eighth grader, you can basically pass a personal training test. Right. Here's a book, study the book, regurgitate the book. Congratulations. You got a C+.
Right.
But NASM, I mean, working through that group and again, now having something that was sort of systematized towards how you teach exercise. You know, they had basically like a 6-step program of how to teach any exercise, all machine-based, but it did make a tremendous amount of sense. Hmm. So it was one of the first, that was the first course that I took that started to even more fine-tune what I was teaching and what I was sharing. Hmm. And I mean, I actually enjoyed that relationship so much that I communicated with them a little bit and hosted a couple at the gym we were at. Just because I liked it so much, I thought it'd be really valuable for the staff. So invited them to come and they would give us, you know, 4 or 5 slots. But what I really wanted for my staff was to have a common language around teaching. Mm. So that if we're talking about, you know, educating this person or that person or utilizing this machine or whatever, we all had kind of a common ground to speak from, even if it was just biomechanical. Mm. So Goldman was probably the first. Tom Purvis, another huge influence with the RTS program. That program just blew my mind. It was like putting on the goggles and being able to see things that weren't there before. Because Tom, cool, being a physical therapist, I mean, he came at it from a completely different direction and really understood the physics and the mechanics. And I learned things in that course. It was 5 days in Oklahoma that I still use because it's like seeing lines of pull. Like you can look at anything happening or anything moving or how a cam moves and still see that. Mm-hmm. That was the first that really blew my mind and gave me a completely different sort of lens to view things through.
Very cool.
That was big. Mark Verstegen's work at Athletes Performance, also very influential. I think Mike Boyle, followed Mike for the longest time. And his is still one of the few certification programs that requires that you demonstrate what you know. And I continue to have a serious amount of respect for that. I mean, he's been in the field, I don't know, 10 years longer than me, and he's worked with absolutely everybody. But a lot of the principles that I continue to use in my own work are the same that Mike uses. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, lots of good quality people have obviously influenced you. I ran into Purvis's work. I never took his course, but I ran into his work when I was doing my muscle activation certification because he had done a sort of a parallel program with Roscov, who had built muscle activation, and they were kind of working together a bit. This would be back in 2000, I think. Sort of a segue, but where do you meet your ex-wife? And she obviously comes with her son, and then you guys have more kids together. When does that start? When you get into living in Chicago or later?
Yeah. Yeah. I think she moved to Chicago from Philly in 93, probably.
Okay.
And she was working at the front desk at the gym I was at. So okay. Saw each other every day, and it took a minute for her to realize how wonderful I am. I mean, it took a lot of me telling her, but eventually we got there. I think we started dating in 94. We got married in 95. Her son had been, I think, in Arizona. And I started communicating with her son just via a letter, because there's no email, there's no nothing at this point. So we sent a couple of letters back and forth, and I wanted to understand that I was serious and that I understood that this is a package deal. Mm-hmm. This is not just, it's you and then there's him. I mean, mm-hmm. he's the number one priority, and then I'm just kind of rounding out the equation. But that was 95. And it's funny, but we were expecting by the time we were married. Mm. And I remember being at my 10-year high school reunion and looking around and seeing people who were married and they had kids. And I thought, when I was here for my 5th reunion, that's not how things at all. I'm like, this all happens in 5 years? That's just crazy. And then when I went back for my 10th, I was married and I had 2 kids.
Wow.
So I'm like, yeah, it does happen in 6 years. Life happens fast.
Yeah. How did the call it the immediate indoctrination into parenthood sort of inform your future fatherhood as a birth parent in some sense? Like, if you follow where I'm coming from.
Yeah. That's a great question, Scott. I mean, it did and it didn't. Mm. Because by the time we got married, her son was 5. Mm. So, I mean, he's a full-fledged human that you can take out and play soccer with and, coach. Right. And then when my son was born, that's a completely different thing, because now you're dealing with this child is helpless unless I do something. And there is no manual. So having a 5-year-old is not necessarily informing anything about the infant, except that eventually that this will become that at some point, given enough affection and support and watering. But it didn't give me a whole lot of information. So
you were still in shock.
I was still in shock. I mean, in both cases, because really immediately getting, acquiring a son at 5 isn't necessarily that different than having an infant, because if you've never done it before, there's no instructional manual for a 5-year-old either.
Mm-hmm.
And 5-year-old already has his own moods and attitudes and stuff that you're not really aware of until you're aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
So in both cases, it's a learning process.
Mm-hmm.
You're dealing with another human being and you just need to kind of figure out what the relationship is going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool experiences.
Yeah. How did becoming a father change you?
Oof. This is actually probably very cliche, but you don't realize how much you can care about someone until mm-hmm. you have your child
mm-hmm.
sitting in front of you and realizing that you are everything that they have, and they rely on you for absolutely everything.
Mm-hmm.
So okay, there are moments of terror there. We all as parents have moments of terror, like, what do I do? But on the other hand, I think if you really look at it, one of the things that we have to realize is that we all figured it out.
Mm-hmm.
for better or for worse, we all figured it out. And I mean, as a parallel for life in general, that's kind of what we're all doing on a daily basis. Because we all still have new relationships, old relationships, whether they're family or coworkers or community, we're all just figuring it out.
Mm-hmm.
So I think if nothing else, it gives you a chance to start over and realize how important you can be when you're influencing somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're a blank slate. So that blank slate is always going to be at least some sort of reflection of how they're treated.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, it's like coaching athletes, you know, they're somehow going to be a reflection of what they're exposed to.
Mm-hmm.
I think the challenge from most people's perspective is like, what do you want to absorb?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What's important to absorb?
So obviously you guys, because she was your ex-wife, you guys went through a period that where things didn't work out.
Yeah.
Does that create, like, I saw you sort of talking about some of the other shifts in your, call it, professional trajectory, getting into nutrition and mindset. Were those precipitated by the dissolution of your relationship, or were they just natural progressions in who you were? Or was there a need to sort of understand yourself better in some sense too?
I think it was a coming back to a somewhat earlier version of myself.
Hmm.
You know, so I mentioned in that, in the bio, that it, like as a young trainer at 23, 24, 25, I wanted to be kind of a fitness Swiss Army knife. I didn't want to I didn't want to come to a problem without a potential solution.
Hmm.
So I took as many opportunities as I could take that were going to further expand my experience or opportunity to help people when I was young. So I don't know, between the first one, I probably took 6 or 7 or 8 different certifications, all in kind of different veins, but all just designed to, you know, create a well-rounded person that could come to help.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, in a way, it's like that same like superhero thing that underlies the whole thing. It's like, what's the secret identity?
Mm-hmm.
The secret identity is somebody who can help you.
Right.
And who can be self-reliant.
Mm.
So when things started to fall apart, I went back to that sort of looking outside for more information.
Mm.
Things might, you know, my, as you say, my trajectory was changing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there had been a gap in the pursuit of more education.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, when things were moving more towards the end, I did kind of look into nutrition, and I went out into mindset coaching, you know, now branching out into neuro.
Mm-hmm.
All those things are still kind of informing what I'm doing.
Right.
But there was always just that little piece of, can I put myself in the position where, regardless of what the situation is or who the person is, can I be some type of solution?
Mm-hmm. And is all this going on when you decide to start eating sports and your own thing, or
that
what precipitates your decision to go into that or do your own thing?
Eating sports and fitness, I started in 2010, and that was about 2 or 3 years before I left the club that I'd been in for such a long time.
Mm.
No, wait, that's not correct. That was, okay, so it was 1990 to 2003. So it was 7 years later. And I had essentially moved to another gym for a year. Disaster. And then essentially went out on my own, found some studios. I could stand on my own. But from an accounting standpoint, I think it more stemmed from a conversation with an accountant, and he said, listen, you know, it makes sense based on your current business model and what you're earning, you should really do something with an LLC or an S corp, just to be in better stead when tax time rolls around.
Right.
So Eaton Sports and Fitness was basically the opportunity to more formalize, not just from a tax standpoint, but to kind of be able to advertise, all right, well, this is what I'm looking to participate in. And it's without excluding anybody, sports and fitness, enough of an umbrella where I can communicate with just about everybody.
So what was I would say kind of, whether it's learning and or recognition point of shifting from being sort of a part of something bigger than you and being surrounded by other people in a bigger organization, and then being self-reliant, you know, you're driving your own bus and it's your bus and you're in the bus. Was that a hard shift or a relieving shift, or what was that? How did that feel for you?
It's an interesting question, Scott, because both leaving the club and the dissolution of marriage created something similar. I spent 13 years at that club in various guises, and then I was 23 years married, and my persona was very much wrapped up in both of those things. So as a member of that gym fit community, I had roles, I had friendships, I had relationships, I had responsibilities. And then when that ended, that persona, that person really kind of ended with it, because I wasn't part of that anymore.
Right.
And a parallel thing happened when my marriage ended, because I'd been a partner, I'd been a co-parent, I'd been a sole provider, and all of the components of a very complex relationship were suddenly, again, put aside. So there is something to that, where there's this almost ongoing requirement to rediscover who you are when you leave a situation like that. And it's, it could be looked at like as a mild existential crisis, because it's like, all right, well, who am I now? Right. Because now I don't have any of these responsibilities. It's just me. And my responsibilities are only really to my kids and to the relationships that I've fostered in the professional community and with my clients. So it takes a little bit of awareness to realize that you've got to kind of step back for a second and realize you can recreate yourself all over again. And I think sometimes you have to, because those personas, you need to let them go in order to be able to kind of grow into something else.
That precipitates a good timing for my book reading session. I read from my book, The Day You Were Born, to each person. You were born February 17th, is that correct? Okay, so you're an Aquarius 8. So your purpose is to use your great observational skills to get ahead, gain complete understanding of yourself, so that you lose your fear of change, and then to use your success to contribute to something to your community. Fate gives us the hand and we play the cards. Arthur Schopenhauer. No matter what Aquarius 8s decide to do with their lives, they will feel as though someone else has had a hand in the decision. Don't worry, he knows what he's doing. They have incredible observational skills. They also have great... He knows what he's doing. They also have great psychological understanding. This gives them insight into themselves and an edge in the world. They can be too self-critical and too tough on others. Aquarius 8s take on too much responsibility and deal with depression. They need courage to face their dark side and own it. Once they look at all things that make them feel unworthy, they get strong. Then success will come at a steady pace. They must listen to their inner voice and open up their world. Aquarius 8s must learn to use the power of the collective force to their advantage. They prefer being their own boss and should stay free of situations in which They have to take orders. They value their freedom and are driven to succeed.
That's pretty spot on. That's crazy. That's just wild.
That's a wild book.
Yeah.
I have fun with that. So you and I meet in this mentorship Applied Neurology several years ago now and kind of get connected through that. And I'm just kind of wondering what brought you to that and how has it changed the way you look at human movement and what you do now professionally, comparatively speaking to, you know, pre 3 years ago or so.
Yeah. So the connection was actually through the mindset course that I was taking.
Mm.
And the husband and wife that run the mindset course are close friends with the husband and wife that ran the neuro course.
Mm-hmm.
And just as a matter of doing business or integrating the two families, the couple that ran that run Next Level Neuro did a kind of what was supposed to be a one-off about the neurology of mindset inside that community. And there were just some of those moments where you kind of go, that makes so much sense. That makes so much sense. And I think there were so many of us that were kind of blown away by just like how wide our eyes got during those conversations, that it turned into a certification program inside the mindset group, which was, you know, the neurology of mindset certification. And it started to explain not just why the mindset course being taught the way that it was being taught was a valid valid approach from a neurological and human learning perspective, but it opened so many more. I mean, for every question it answered, it was like there's two more questions. So like, what about this?
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't long after I left the mindset group that Next Level showed up, and it was an opportunity to do more and learn more, but more specifically apply it to sort of the biomechanical field.
Mm-hmm.
And that's me.
Mm-hmm.
Doing everything from a biomechanical standpoint for 30 something years. But the brain is really something that I never dug into.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded very interesting. And everything that had been presented so far in that field sounded really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
So I jumped in. And much like the RTS program that Burbis taught, it was just a mind-blowing, like, how could I have missed this growing up, not recognizing that the nervous system is such an immense component of the integrated whole. And the very first thing that kind of blew my mind was the separation of pain and injury.
Mm.
And this fact that pain is 100% an output of the brain every single time.
Mm.
It changed my own relationship to it. Because, you know, for whatever, since I was 12, 11, you go to the gym, you do something stupid and, you know, do an ego lift and something gets tweaked. I figure, well, I'm out of the gym for a week, two. I got to let that calm down. Got to do other things. Completely changed my relationship with pain, with how my body works, with how aware I am of how integrated everything is.
Hmm.
And I thought, God, if I had known that like 20 years ago, I'd be a completely different path.
Yeah.
But I'm here now. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, let's learn as much as we can about this and implement it and integrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And from someone who spent 35 years trying to fix everything from a mechanical, physics-based place, to be able to come back in and say, okay, this thing that used to take me weeks and weeks and weeks to try and resolve from a positional standpoint, to resolve a lot of that or resolve it entirely in the space of a session or two was just incredible.
Right. Yeah. And
there's so much to learn, and I'm just playing it on repeat until it sinks in. So
yeah, it's a big rabbit hole, but it's an interesting one.
It is a big rabbit hole, but I think it's worth it. It creates a lot of very interesting conversations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm on the same wavelength as you with that sort of epiphany. The other one for me that was really large was this whole idea of threat. Yeah. And it made me recognize so much more how, you know, growing up in the industry of human performance, there was always this desire in the industry to dissociate these different silos of professional practice. Where, you know, you had the psychologist and the physiologist and the strength coach and the therapist, and everybody had their sort of their letters on the wall and their sort of commitment to what they did. And yet the whole thing, they're non-dissociative, your brain and your body and what you feel and what you don't feel and how you manifest, et cetera, all of these things are interrelated. So you can't kind of pull them apart as they're all one, right? So
right.
The way you are feeling right now has more to do with a whole set of dominoes that you're sort of ignoring than the one that is loudest right now, the one that's making the noise, yeah. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. And that threat bucket concept is, I think, probably the conversation I have the most in trying to explain that we tend to only look at threat like, you know, pain is a threat output, but we're not looking at, you know, the bad day at work, the breakup, the bad marriage, the not being happy with the job, you know, the fact that the furnace broke. It's like all of that stuff is in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets to a certain level, you get outputs. I think that idea that all of it is in the same bucket is really important to understand, that it's not just physical stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually physical, emotional, psychological. Everything's in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
And that brain gets to a point that it's like, okay, I'm tapping out.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, pain, anxiety, indigestion, tightness, pick your poison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of to not bring it to a close, because I want to circle back onto some things, but you know, you had a very difficult life circumstance occur about 18 months ago. Your ex-wife took her life, and I don't necessarily want to get into the brass tacks of what happened there, but what I am curious about is how your mindset journey and your neuro journey served you in the management of dealing with what that was for you and for your kids and for everything else that went on. Like, how did it help you get through it in some sense?
Yeah, that's having spent so much time with her. We were together for 25 years, married for 23. I had seen kind of the roller coaster. And when things finally ended, there was shock, but understanding. Like I knew what her story was from the very beginning. I understood what she had been fighting and not dealing with from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
The most challenging part of it as a parent is to try and help your kids navigate that.
Mm.
And I mean, and really like anything, a parent trying to help your kids navigate anything isn't easy, because they're on their own path, and you can try and, you know, we can try and inform them.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, I had said to my daughter when this happened, I said, look, I understand, but I can't possibly understand, you know, like I understand on my level, but I don't understand it on the level of losing your mom. In that way.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of my own processing of that, I think, came out in helping them process it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's always kind of a draw to guilt. Like, what didn't I do? What could right. I have? What should I have done? I mean, I was the last person to see her alive. And it was that we had a, I drove her back to her office and dropped her off. And we'd had a fairly normal conversation that morning. And that was it. There was no, there was no indication that that was impending. But I think the thing that I shared with my daughter was, you know, this, this sense that she felt like if she had loved me more, she would have stayed.
Mm.
And I said, what you need to understand is that her love for you and the pain that she was in, those things coexist. Mm. It's not a scale. It's not one is outweighing the other. I mean, it's, they coexist at the same time.
Mm.
And when you get to a point that I think she felt at the end that she was alone and that she had no further avenues that she could follow to try and feel better. That was her choice.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the other thing is like, it's her choice.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, like you could put a gun to somebody's head and try and coerce them to do something, but it's still their choice as to whether or not they say yes or no. So we have very limited power to try and make somebody do something, to make them feel something, to make them feel better. It's all comes down to choice. And when we gathered for the memorial, I had said to the room full of people, I said, look, you know, at the end, she felt as if she was alone and she had nothing and couldn't go to anybody else. And I said, however, we're sitting in a room full of people who at a phone call would have come to be with her, help her out in whatever way. And I think that's really important to recognize is that we can see it from the outside, but with the level of pain that she was dealing with from the inside, she had reinforced that story over and over and over again to the point that it was completely real.
Mm.
And any evidence that she ran across in the world to the contrary didn't exist.
Right.
So, I mean, it's very much like, you know, what we focus on expands.
Mm-hmm.
To quote a good friend of ours, the story we tell becomes the truth you believe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if that, so that was the story. And she made a choice based on that story.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, I mean, it was like wrenching to know that it happened. There was a little bit of a pang knowing that I was the last person to see her and thinking, could I have said something? Could I have done something? Could I have? But when you start digging into the situation and I found some, you know, notes and letters and this and that, she'd been planning it for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So nothing that I was going to say or do or her friends or her daughter or whatever was going to change the choice that she made.
Right.
She was going to have to find a way to change her mind, to tell a different story, and to believe that something else was possible.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't.
Hmm. Really powerful share. Thank you for doing that. I know it's probably not easy. One of the things I noticed about you, tell me right or wrong, but it's funny reading that piece, was I got the impression that the first year you went through the mentorship, a lot was going on in your life and you were sort of distracted to a degree. And then the second year you really dove in. And now I feel like you really have connected with the community that it is. And in some sense, that is something that means something to you. So maybe as kind of a last question, what is the meaningfulness of that community in your life at this point, and sort of where are you headed on your own journey at this point in your life as well?
Yeah, it's funny how things kind of work in ellipses. So right, the first year of the mentorship, fourth quarter was when everything fell apart, was when my wife took her life. So I kind of disappeared in that fourth quarter. I was gone. The benefit, one of the benefits of the program is that if you want to come back and retake the mentorship and keep trying to learn more, is that you can. Mm-hmm. So M3, the mentorship group, for whatever reason, was a very tight group. I mean, the personalities gelled, and I like, and maybe part of it was that I needed it at the time, mm-hmm. that it was really great. Very much like the first certification course that I took, to be in the presence of people who were all on a similar journey, even if they're coming from a bunch of different places, because that is the mentorship. You've mm-hmm. got all sorts of people from all over the world in this group, but all on a journey together to just understand better how this whole thing works. So from a community standpoint, it was super, super valuable to be able to re-enter that community, even if it was with a different group. Mm. I think personally, I needed it. I needed to have people around me that were on that journey together, who I could see every week and who I could just be myself with and just sit there and crack jokes and not get in trouble for it, mostly. But moving forwards, you know, I'm staying with it again, because again, in a long loop, when I recognized that the physical training that I had picked up had given me something foundational to work on that I could kind of carry forwards in here, but also share it outwardly with the goal of having other people be able to feel that little underlying level of confidence, mm-hmm. is similar to where I am here, where I want to learn it well enough that I can effectively communicate it out to just about anybody. Mm-hmm. Because in that pursuit of being the Swiss Army knife and being able to help a lot of people, this has really been a missing link in everything that I pulled into this kind of melon to this point, that allows me now another language to speak, to integrate it, mm-hmm. and help people understand. And my strength as a teacher initially was, and I think remains to be, being able to explain things to people in a way that doesn't make them feel stupid. Mm. You know, like, you want people to get better, and they're not going to get better if they feel like they're being spoken down to, and right. feel like they don't know something.
Right.
So that is where I find some symbiotic nature with the mentorship, because that's the way it's taught too. It's a matter of, okay, we're going to take a year to teach this. We're going to teach it piece by piece so that you can take the knowledge and then go out and practice it and then come back and we can discuss it and talk about it in the community and then repeat. It reminds me a lot of being back in the small community in that one little rented room doing that first certification course in whatever, 1990, to now being in a bigger room where, you know, really big names meet and practice things, but still with the underlying plan of just having enough knowledge to reach out there and be able to help people move forwards. Mm-hmm. If I can help enough other people move forwards, that moves me forwards too,
I think. Cool. Yeah. Well, good on you, man. I love, we old cats keep growing, and that's the, you know, that's the best part of getting old, is just keep metamorphosizing yourself, so to speak. So
keep gaining new perspectives.
Yeah. Thanks for taking the time. It's been nice to get to know you a little deeper, and appreciate your time, Andrew.
Thanks very much. And congratulations on 6 years.
Thanks, buddy. Yeah, have a good one. Thanks for joining us today on Leave Your Mark. I hope we've left a mark on you today, and we wish only that you pay it forward by sharing this story, taking the time to rate and comment on this podcast. Please follow us at Twitter at Built by Scott and Instagram at King O'Payne, and become a member of this community at Scott G. Livingston on Facebook. Have a great day. Music by Cedric de Saint-Rome.